Right now, we're in the middle of a series called Running with the Giants. Studies from the lives of biblical heroes. God put a large part of the Bible in story form, narrative form. And he did so because he knows that we resonate with stories in a way that, you know, we're not going to resonate with the best lecture in the world. We can identify with the heroes in stories and with the villains. And so what we're going to do the next few weeks is take a look at some of the heroes of the Bible and see if we can figure out at least one of the lessons that God put them in there for us to learn from. Last week, we took a look at Esther. Esther was a young lady who had a hard time going public with her faith. And we talked about the challenge that is for each of us and how it is that we can do that more effectively. This week, we're going to take a look at Jacob. And I'm calling today's message, Heads I Win, Tails You Lose. You guys ever had someone pull that on you back on the playground? Heads I win, tails you lose. You know, it's like someone walks up, hey man, slip for it. Heads I win, tails you lose. Okay, wait. Heads I win, tails you lose. Hey, you're trying to cheat me. That is like the theme story of Jacob's life. Jacob, one of the great patriarchs of Israel. In fact, Jacob is the one after whom Israel is named. He gets his name changed to Israel later. The father of the 12 tribes of Israel was a scoundrel. He was a total scalawag. I was trying to think about how I could best communicate Jacob's character to you, and I thought of this video clip. I do not know if you guys have ever seen Abbott and Costello before, but Abbott and Costello are some of my absolute favorite comedians of all time. They're clean. They're hilarious. They're the ones responsible for that famous comedy routine, Who's On First? Everybody's seen that, I hope. Best comedy routine of all time, as declared by Time Magazine, at least. And so what we're going to do is watch a very brief clip from them in which they demonstrate for us the nature of Jacob.
I'm a bad boy.
That is the theme story of the first half of Jacob's life. In case you don't know the story of Jacob, I'm going to recap it for you very quickly. And I'm going to try to draw your attention to what I think is perhaps the central lesson that we can learn from Jacob's life. Jacob was the son of Isaac. He was a twin son. His brother was named Esau. As Esau and Jacob came out of the womb, his mother had a very hard pregnancy. She said, it's like they're fighting inside me. They're going at it like cats and dogs. Finally, Esau and Jacob are born. Esau comes out first, and Jacob comes on, and he's got him by the heel. He's grabbed on. And so that's why he got his name, Jacob, which means heel grabber or supplanter. And as they go on through their life, Jacob begins to live out that very, very early snapshot of his character. He's always grabbing after his brother. So one day, his brother's out hunting. And his brother comes in and he's just famished. And he's like, oh, give me some food. And Jacob goes, okay, sell me your birthright. Say what? Your place in the will. You're the firstborn. I want what you're going to get. Give it to me. All I want is some soup, man. You want the soup? You got to give me your birthright. Okay, swear it. All right, you can have my birthright. Just give me the soup. And then Jacob held him to it. He was such a sneak. Later on, his father is on his deathbed, dying. His father, Isaac. And his father calls for his favorite son, Esau, the old one. Come to me, and I will give you a great blessing. And Jacob's like, oh, I want that. I want the blessing. And so he goes in, and his father's very, very, got cataracts, very, very hard to see. And so he tries to disguise himself as his brother. And so what he does is he kind of rubs himself down with his brother's, you know, smell by putting his clothes on and stuff. And he puts some animal skins on because his brother's way hairy and got coarse skin. And he goes in, and in fact, I've got it in here for you. He goes to his father and says, my father? Yes, my son, Isaac answered. Who is it? I am Esau, your firstborn. I've done as you told me. Please sit up and eat some of my game so that you may give me your blessing. Goes on through the whole charade of, you know, touch me, smell. It's like, you know, the Little Red Riding Hood, you know. My grandma, what big teeth you have. Why, Esau, what hairy skin you have. Are you really my son Esau? He asked. I am, Jacob replied. And he steals the dying breath of his father in blessing on him from his brother. Now, this drives his brother. That's the straw that breaks camel's back. His brother decides, I'm going to kill that little twerp once my dad dies. I don't want to break my dad's heart and be responsible for his death. But once dad's gone, he's going too. He gets word. So basically, he beats feet, runs town, and goes to live with his uncle Laban. Goes to Uncle Laban, and he's also going in quest for a wife, a spouse, and he sees this beautiful young girl named Rachel, goes to his uncle and says, hey, I want to marry her. What do I need to do? You got to work for me 7 years. That sounds like a fair deal. So he begins working for his uncle 7 years in order to earn the hand of his spouse, Rachel. Wedding night comes. Big deal. Jacob gets all drunk, you know, slosh, gets thrown in the tent, wakes up in the morning, finds out he's not sleeping with Rachel. He's sleeping with Rachel's ugly sister, Leah. And Laban has tricked Jacob, just like Jacob's been tricking everybody else his whole life. Jacob is hot under the collar. He goes to Laban, what's the big deal? Oh, well, it's kind of this custom. You couldn't have mentioned it 6 years ago when I started working on this? So he says, tell you what, just finish the honeymoon, and then I'll give you the other girl too, but you got to work for me 7 more years. Okay, so I'm feeling sorry for poor Leah right now. Comes off her honeymoon, and then bam, her husband's sleeping with another woman. Her sister, the pretty one, who everybody likes better, going along, and Jacob starts working for Laban. At the end of this, he's got two wives who fight like cats and dogs, cannot stand one another, and he's got nothing. He's dirt poor, penniless. And so he goes to his uncle, says, you know what, I probably need to get out of here. I need to go earn a living for my family. And he says, tell you what, you've been a really good employee. I feel like God's blessing me because of what you're doing. And so why don't you stay on and work for a few more years, and I'll pay you for it. That sounds pretty good. How are you going to pay me? They kind of work this deal out, where Jacob is going to get all of basically the blemished animals in the herd. He's going to shepherd for his uncle, and he's going to get the spotted ones and the ones that just don't look normal. So that's the deal. As soon as that deal is struck, now they're not like, you know, infirm or anything. They just are a different color on the colt, on the coat. And so as soon as he does this, Laban sends his sons out into the field. They take all the differently colored animals, and they bring them off to another herd. Now, you know genetics as well as I do. If you got a bunch of animals that all look the same, like, you know, you got a bunch of black cats in the room, are you going to have a white cat born from that litter? Not too likely. And so Jacob's being swindled by Laban again. But Jacob decides he's going to counter-swindle Laban. And so what he does is he sets up this real elaborate scheme. And just to cut to the chase, chapter 30, verses 37 to 39. Jacob took fresh-cut branches from poplar, almond, and plane trees and made white stripes in them by peeling the bark and exposing the inner wood of the branches. Then he placed the peeled branches in all the watering troughs so that they would be directly in front of the flocks when they came to drink. When the flocks were in heat and came to drink, they mated in front of the branches, and they bore young that were streaked or speckled or spotted. And then Jacob keeps breeding them in a certain way. So what he does is basically kind of trust in some folk wisdom, in the leading scientific theories of his day, which basically went like whatever you're looking at when you impregnate something, that is going to be passed on to the character of your offspring. Now, genetically today, we know that's nonsense. Jacob, however, he was just going with the flow, living with his culture. Scientists tell us that if you do this, this will happen. Therefore, I will do it, and you know, we'll just see what happens. Lo and behold, all these animals are born, and he's got more than half of Laban's herd when it's all said and done. Laban is hacked. So Jacob flees town. He just runs without telling his uncle he's going. He just takes his herds, takes his wives, and just heads off. Laban comes after him, ready to kill him, and then they kind of have this peace treaty merge between them. He goes back home, and on his way back home, he meets God. Now, throughout this, you may have noticed a certain trend. Jacob's always scheming to get what he wants. He's angling. He's making things happen his own way. Now, the interesting thing is, we know from the rest of the Bible that what he wanted was actually God's plan for him. The things he was after were good things. God had intended to give him that blessing and to give him that birthright. But Jacob felt like he needed to seize it in his own deceptive way and produced great tension in his family as a result. God had intended to make Jacob very, very wealthy, but all of Jacob's wealth came through cheats, the kind of stuff that we just saw in this video clip. God had intended to do it, but Jacob tried to make it happen in his own way, and again, almost caused his own death through conflict with his uncle. In fact, if you read the text, by the way, Jacob, you can read about in Genesis 25 to 35. He's in that 10-chapter range there. You get in there, and it seems that if God had not appeared to Laban and said, please don't kill Jacob, that he would have done just that. Jacob was making his life harder despite the fact he was trying to make it better because of the way he was going about it. You see, Jacob had plans, but all along, God was the one providing, not because of Jacob's plans, but despite Jacob's plans. Read with me here. So I opened up with the story of Jacob tricking his brother into selling his birthright for stew, for gumbo, for a little bit of sauce. What we read in Romans chapter 9, 10 through 16, Paul's explaining. Don't forget what happened to the twin sons of Isaac and Rebekah. Even before they were born, or had done anything good or bad, like tried to trick their father, the Lord told Rebekah that her older son would serve the younger one. The Lord said this to show that he makes his own choices, and that it wasn't because of anything either of them had done. That's why the scriptures say that the Lord liked Jacob more than Esau. Are we saying that God is unfair? Certainly not. The Lord told Moses that he has pity and mercy on anyone he wants to. Everything, then, depends on God's mercy and not what people want or do. God was going to give Jacob that birthright. The older son was going to be subservient to the younger son, which was unheard of in that culture. But Jacob felt the need to season himself. It would have gotten to him one way or another, but because of the way he did it, he made his life harder and had to be isolated from his family for a number of years. Moving on, to get the blessing from his father, the blessing that was promised to Abraham, that through your descendants I'll make a great nation, goes to Isaac. He wants to be the one who carries on that promise. Because Esau, it turns out, we read later in the Bible in Hebrews, is a godless person. He cares nothing for God. But Jacob, although he's a weasel, he's trying to be a godly weasel. He's that kind of person who, like, on the one hand, really loves God, and on the other hand, really loves sin. And is like sort of torn between the two. It's like he's got horses chained to either side of him pulling. And he goes one way or the other. And so oftentimes he tries to do the right thing in a very, very wrong way. So he tricks his dad to try and get this blessing. But what we see in Genesis 28, 12 through 15, just after this happens, is God appears to Jacob. And Jacob had a dream in which he saw a stairway resting on the earth with its top reaching to heaven. And the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. There above it stood the Lord, and he said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. Jacob felt as though the only way he was going to get God's blessing is if he tricked his dad. Turns out God was planning to just give it to him directly all along. But Jacob was too impatient to wait and find out. And I see a real key to Jacob's character and what happens right after that. God appears to him and says, I'm going to do this for you. And so what does Jacob do? This isn't in your handout, but if you have your Bible, Genesis 28, starting in verse 20. Then Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me, if God will be with me and will watch over me on this journey I'm taking and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear so that I return safely to my father's house, then the Lord will be my God. And the stone that I have set up as a pillar will be the God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give you a tenth. He's trying to strike a deal with God. God just said, hey, it's Christmas. I'm Santa. Here's your present. And he's like, how much do I owe you for that? Let's see, if I promise to be good, and I promise to tithe, and I promise to do this, that, and the other, and if you do these things for me, I think we might be able to work things out. He's still trying to scheme, to put one over on God, to do two-tenths for a five. Heads I win, tails you lose. Then he goes, and he meets someone who's even more devious than him, Laban. And they do this whole scheme, counter-scheme thing. And he tries to do this trick to get rich on Laban. Now, the thing is, we know now, that trick should not have worked. I mean, it's not. I mean, you go to any farmer today. Anybody here raised on a farm? Didn't think so. But you raised on a farm. I mean, anybody here have pet dogs? I mean, you can't get a Great Dane by putting a giant poster of a Great Dane in front of your Chihuahuas while they're making baby Chihuahuas. You're going to get baby Chihuahuas. It's the way genetics works. What you got is what you give. So how is it that this actually came to pass if it was not because of Jacob's trickery and schemes? Genesis 31, 10 to 13. This is right when Jacob's decided, okay, I've got my herd, my cousins are mad at me, my uncle wants to kill me, I'm gonna get out of here. God appears to him in a dream. As he's thinking about running, and he says to his wives, he's trying to explain to his wives, his uncle's daughters, why it is he's going to leave. In breeding season, I once had a dream in which I looked up and saw that the male goats mating with the flock were streaked, speckled, or spotted. The angel of God said to me in the dream, Jacob. I answered, yo. Actually said, here I am. That was an editorial comment. And he said, look up and see that all the male goats mating with the flock are streaked, speckled, or spotted. For I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and where you made a vow to me. Now leave this land at once and go back to your native land. In other words, your trick didn't work at all. Instead, what I had happen was right before they split the flocks up, there were a bunch of very lucky goats. And they passed all the genetic material along. And then the herds were split up. And I worked it after that because I'm God. So that the genetic material you needed to get your part of the deal worked out got passed on. Your tricker had nothing to do with it. I'm God. You had a plan, but I was providing for you. Incidentally, those of you who are wrestling with whether or not God will ever give you a spouse, it may be some solace to realize that God is sovereign even over the mating habits of goats. And so perhaps he will also do something for you. Hopefully nothing streaked, speckled, or spotted, though. So, for what it's worth. And so Jacob is coming back. Now, the thing is, he's in peril. He's coming back to a brother who has sworn to kill him, and who has had years to solidify his status within the tribe. Even though he sold his birthright, and sold his, and didn't receive the blessing from his father, his brother left. And so the one who's actually not supposed to be leading the tribe is the one who's been there. And absence makes the heart go wonder. And so he goes back, and Esau's in charge, even though Esau's not supposed to be in charge, even though it's supposed to be Jacob. And Esau is sworn to kill him. So he's getting more and more nervous the closer and closer he gets to home. And he finally gets there, and he starts trying to scheme again. He's like, maybe if I bribe him and do this and do that. And then he gets alone. And in his aloneness, this happens. Genesis 32, verses 24 to 30. This left Jacob all alone in the camp. And a man came and wrestled with him until dawn. When the man saw that he could not win the match, he struck Jacob's hip and knocked it out of joint at the socket. Then the man said, "Let me go, for it is dawn." But Jacob panted, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." "What is your name?" the man asked. He replied, "Jacob." "Your name will no longer be Jacob," the man told him. "It is now Israel, because you have struggled with both God and men and have won." "What's your name?" Jacob asked him. "Why do you ask?" the man replied. Then he blessed Jacob there. Jacob named the place Peniel, face of God, for he said, "I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been spared." And from then on, we see a change beginning in Jacob. He stops being a schemer and starts being a truster because he was broken in an encounter with God. Anybody here ever wrestle in high school? I had a friend, Faz, we called him, Frazlo, Frazier Hudson, back in high school. Remarkable guy, absolutely remarkable guy. He was about my height. He could bench press 205 when he was like 16. I mean, he was like as wide as a cart, and he was a wrestler. And he and I would occasionally, try to wrestle, actual wrestling, not WWF. We try to do the thing. He tried to teach me some moves. And always, I would end up like a pretzel. I mean, I was like, I did not know my ear could touch that part of my body. That's amazing. Eventually I'd have to tap out and he'd let me go. And the thing that I learned in that process is that wrestling is all about knowing yourself and knowing your body. The way that I was driven home to me for sure is that I was in college, and I saw this one guy. He was a judo guy. I believe that at the time, I may have the exact ranking wrong, because then I was phone number to call him up and ask, but he was ranked like 19 in the world in his weight class for judo. Judo's like Asian wrestling. It's like a very, very body-oriented thing. Here's the thing. He was blind. He could not see. But he beat everybody but 18 other people on this planet when it came to judo. Why? He did not know them. He couldn't watch their tapes. He couldn't gear up for the match by trying to figure out and get inside their head. Basically, he knew one thing. He knew his body. He knew his moves. And once he had a hand on you, you were in a world of hurt. And that's why I find it so significant that Jacob wrestled with God. You see, Jacob had a problem with being himself. In fact, that was the root of all his troubles. The way Jacob got way off course at the beginning was he pretended to be someone else. Who are you? I'm Esau. Are you really Esau? Yeah, I'm really Esau. And Jacob's been living a lie ever since, living the consequences of that lie. It's not like the talented Mr. Ripley. He hasn't pretended to be Jacob ever since. But he's been living under the shadow of that ever since. And God grabs him, and he knows it's God. It's very clear from the story. He's got a sense. There's an odd glow about you, literally. I don't know. But they're wrestling. And then God says, "What is your name?" Exact same question he was asked some 20 years ago by his father. "What is your name? Who are you?" And this time, he comes clean. I'm Jacob. He came to grips with who he was. And as he began to come to grips with who he was, he entered into a whole new level of his relationship with God. He entered into a whole new level of his growth as a moral person. He entered into a whole new level of life, because he acknowledged who he was. But to get him there, God had to break him. God had to twist him, to cripple him. In this case, literally. But it's the same thing he does with us. Oftentimes, we've got inner walls erected that we use to keep God out, that we use to prevent God from doing the work he wants within us. And to do what God needs to do, if we will not. And God gave Jacob plenty of time. I mean, he appeared to, this is like the second time God's appeared to Jacob that we know of for sure. Where God showed up and said, I will be your God. Here's the deal. And Jacob would not respond to God's gentle nudging. So finally, God just grabbed his hand and said, all right, bam, broke his hip. Which will get your attention? Broke Jacob's hip. And then Jacob was ready to come to grips with who he was. Jacob came to grips with who he was, went on, had a non-murderous relationship with his brother after that, and went on to become the father of the 12 tribes of Israel. One of the great heroes of the faith. What's the relevance for us today? I think a couple of things. First, are you real with yourself? Or are you trying to be someone you're not? Because as long as you're trying to be someone that you're not, God will never be able to do what he wants in you and through you. Are you trying to be an older sibling? That perfect one. You got into Stanford. They got into Harvard. Not that I'm saying that East Coast wannabes is any better than us. You understand? You majored in mechanical engineering. They majored in electrical engineering. You had a 3.9. They had a 4.0. You got a great GPA, but they were also good at three sports. You're only good at two. Are you trying to be someone else in your family? Are you trying to be someone else that you know on campus? Oh man, if I could just be like Bob or like Sue, that would be great. They're just so good at everything. And you kill yourself trying to be something that you're not, trying to be good at something you're not good at. Or are you like Jacob, always trying to pursue good things in bad ways? In fact, let me take a detour here. Like Jacob, are you sure that your striving is working? You see, Jacob had no doubt that his scheme with the goats was working. I mean, he tried it and he got the speckled goats. It wasn't until God showed up and said, uh-uh. They had any clue at all the scheme had gone awry. He's like, yes, I made a plan, I pursued it with diligence, and it came to pass. Therefore, I have built my wealth. And then God shows up later, no, I actually did that for you despite what you did. Because that was one dumb plan. How did you get into Stanford? Is it by your own might and striving? Or do you think perhaps God has a reason for you being here? I strongly suspect it's the latter. Now, I have no doubt that you're worthy to be here. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying. But I know people who got into Stanford who didn't get into Harvard, got into Harvard, didn't get into Stanford, got into Yale, didn't get into Princeton, got into Princeton, didn't get into Yale. When you're dealing with schools of this caliber, how good you are is not the determining factor. A lot of things go into it. You have to have a certain minimal level of competence to get past the bar, but once you're in there, God only knows why they make the decisions they do, and I mean that very literally. If you're here instead of there, I would submit it's likely that God had a hand in that. It would behoove you to figure out why it is that God brought you here at this season. What he hopes to do in you and through you to touch this campus and to change you into the person he wants you to be. We often try to assume responsibility for things that are not our responsibility. Good things, godly things that God has promised to take care of, and we work it. How many of you have lost sleep over the salvation of a family member? My mom, my dad, my brother, my sister. Someone that I love, a person I really want to date. I don't know. But you feel like it's your job to make that person become a Christian. No. Not the way I read the Bible. It's your job to be a witness. But it's not your job to be their lawyer. A lawyer tries to work and achieve a certain goal for their client. A witness just tells the truth. Just tell the truth. And leave it up to them and God to work things out. You can't make someone become a Christian. We've tried that before. It doesn't work. And if you don't know, study your history. Maybe you're trying to earn God's favor, earn God's approval, earn God's blessing in your life, just like Jacob was. Maybe in some way you convince yourself that if you just work harder at being a good person, God will love you more. Neglecting what God just said, that, you know, before they had done anything good or bad, I made up my mind. I made up my mind how I was going to feel about him. And God's made up his mind how he's going to feel about you. He loves you. God loves you and he wants to bless you in some very specific ways. Anything that God has promised to you in his word, if you try to work for it in your own power, according to your own plan, you are going to screw things up more than you set things right. What are some things God has promised? Well, let me tell you some things he has not promised. God has not promised you'll get a 4.0. God has not promised you'll become wealthy. God has not promised you will get married. God has not promised a lot of things. The things God has promised are much more profound and important than that. God has promised that if you want it, you will have peace in troubled times. God has promised that if you want it, you can experience joy in the midst of threatening circumstances. God has promised that if you want it, you can have victory over sin. God has promised that if you want it, you can experience forgiveness and redemption and a life that will begin now and never end. And you cannot earn it. You cannot trick God into giving it to you. You cannot make it happen. All you can do is reach out and take it. In fact, that's the most profound lesson of all Christianity. That's what it means to be a Christian. To have accepted what God gives us rather than try to seize it for ourselves. The Bible says it a lot of different ways, all over the place. One of the most famous expressions of it is in Ephesians 2:8. For it is by grace you have been saved, through faith. And this is not from yourselves, it is the gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast. In Romans, it says, for the wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life through Jesus Christ our Lord. Romans 6:23. I know you, most of you. I know most of you are followers of Christ. I don't know all of you. Perhaps there's someone here who's not made that step. It's not a high-pressure thing. If it interests you to discover how it is that you can experience the new life that God offers, the forgiveness, the grace, the redemption, the hope, the purpose, whatever metaphor is most meaningful to you, I would just encourage you to come talk to me after. I would like to talk with you more about that and pray with you.